The following is a CSPN Media podcast presentation.
Hello, and welcome to Know the Score. I'm your host, Don DeLaRente, and I'm joined by my co-host, the Libra icon, Dwayne. What's going on, Dwayne?
Nothing too much. Just maintaining and keeping up with the drama of the country and the drama of sports. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's Joe Biden a lot, Donald Trump a little bit right now as we head into the... 48 hours after the 24 hours after the election, so ballots are still being counted. So hopefully there will be a winner by the end of the week, and we can go into next week with some direction and some clarity. But
exactly.
Thanks for everybody who went out and did their part, their civic duty. Definitely appreciate you and whatever capacity that you did, vote, early voting, mail-in ballot, standing in line the day of on election day. Definitely appreciate you doing your civic duties.
Right.
So we're going to talk about some MLB baseball here to start. We have to give a tip of the cap to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Oh, it's only been about... the last 5 years in the making, but they finally get their World Series trophy. First time in 32 years. That's amazing considering all the talent that they've had. Rookies of the Year, MVPs recently, Clayton Kershaw, Cy Young Award winners. But they win the World Series 4-2 over the Tampa Bay Rays. They basically had to come back and regather themselves after the epic Game 4 loss that they had in a game that was one of the best World Series games I've ever seen. Tampa Bay answered each and every time in Game 4 that they had to. Ended up getting the win with a crazy base hit, then a throwing error that led to the Rays winning that game. But that was the last game they won. The Dodgers won two straight after that. Corey Seager was named the World Series MVP. And like I said, tip of the cap to the Dodgers. The Rays manager made a kind of play that backfired on Game 6 where he took out Blake Snell, who was cruising. It was 2-1, and it looked like the Rays were in pretty good control with Blake Snell on the mound. But then once he got removed out of the game, the Dodgers promptly took the lead. Then Mookie Betts hit a homer in the eighth for the insurance run, and that was all she wrote from there on.
Yeah, after that Game 4, I really wanted this series to go to 7 games. I thought it deserved 7 games, but the Dodgers clearly had other plans. And this is the 7th World Series title for the Dodgers. Like you said, first time in 32 years, and I don't know what went through the decision making of the Rays manager in that World Series, Kevin Cash. I don't know what was going on, why he pulled Blake Snell after that was just the second hit he gave up in that game, and it just really kind of just baffled me why they decided not to. We decided to pull him, and it looked like that was just the wrong move. If that was a gamble, it was a bad one. And now they were the best team in MLB in the 60-game sprint. The Rays are the best in the American League. Yeah, the two best teams, the best team came out and won it, so it's well deserved. Tip of the cap to them. Probably should have been two, maybe three World Series, and maybe two at the minimum if it wasn't for the Astros cheating, but it is what it is. Tip of the cap, LA gets two titles in 1 year, with the Lakers winning the NBA title, so that's definitely a victory party for Dodgers and their fans. So,
in the developing situation that took place in Game 6, Justin Turner was removed from the game after testing positive. He got removed from the game in like the 8th inning. Once they kind of figured out what was going on, Fox alerted everybody what the deal was. And then Justin Turner, who has been highly outspoken about the way that Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, has handled the pandemic and everything, celebrating on the field with no mask on.
Right. Like, kissing his girlfriend and all that good stuff. Just like, passing out, man. Just passing out COVID all over the place. Come on. Like you said, like, you're not thinking. Like, stay in the back. You should have been quarantined. Put you in some kind of bubble or something. That was just all types of bad. All types of bad.
Yeah, so now all the Dodgers got to go through contact tracing for the next, like, couple of days after they won the World Series to make sure nobody's got it. But, you know, it's such a mystery because it's like they've been around him for, like, the, you know, 6 games worth of this. So if it takes, you know, 4 or 5 days for it to manifest in somebody, I mean, they've been high-fiving and batting practices and meetings and all types of stuff. So, you know, it's really hard to, you know, for the guys, I guess, to just be like, well, you know, I've been around them that much, so if I got it, I would have had it by now. So I guess they figured, you know, no harm, no foul. We just won the World Series. We'll deal with that later on.
We'll cross that bridge when we get through it. Yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we get through it.
Yeah, but pop that champagne and get these goggles on.
Right.
Just give a big shout out to Andrew Friedman, kind of the architect of both teams, the Rays and the Dodgers. He basically was the general manager who made the Rays into a viable team, a contender, and not just a doormat in the American League East. And then after some great years there where he got the Rays to the World Series against Philly, he moved on to the Dodgers, and he's finally brought the Dodgers their World Series title that they've been looking for. I had a chance to meet Andrew Friedman almost a decade ago, right when he took the Rays job. He was, you know, super, like, he hadn't even started yet. They had me just announced him, and I got a chance to talk with him, and really smart guy. And really proud to see that, you know, he finally brought that World Series title to the Dodgers. I was hoping he was going to bring it to the Rays just because they're our local AAA affiliate. They're their parent company here in Durham. But just, you know, 6 degrees of separation. Like, hey, I actually know him. So that's pretty
cool. Yeah, that's dope.
One last Major League Baseball note. The Chicago White Sox, they fill their void at manager. They have an up-and-coming young team that seems to be on the verge of, you know, becoming the next upstart team in the American League. They just needed a manager to give their young guys some direction. So they chose Tony La Russa. Ooh. 76-year-old Tony La Russa, who managed the White Sox from 1979 through 1986. So he's back for a second stint in a much different era of baseball culture. So I wonder just how Tony La Russa in 2020, 2021 going forward is going to be able to deal with these young, outspoken guys who are very emotional when it comes to their play on the field and their comments as far as activism and just, you know, playing with flair. So your thoughts, Tony La Russa gonna be too old school for this young up-and-coming Chicago White Sox team?
Well, at least you won't have to worry about a disco demolition night, so that's a positive. So I think it's going to be a very interesting dynamic. I think this is definitely a move by Reinsdorf and the White Sox to get another title to the South Side. This is also an interesting story for me because the AAA affiliate of the White Sox are the Charlotte Knights. So that's going to be interesting to see where the Knights go, because a lot of the players that did come up through the ranks were in Charlotte. So definitely always kept an eye on the White Sox. And I think that his winning mentality, his old school approach, will give this team the discipline, because I think they're a team that has the tools, but they need to be harnessed. And I think he's the guy that can get those tools harnessed, and they can go places. He's a proven winner. It's going to be a very interesting, I think, what was the last time he was with the Cardinals, like 14 or 13?
Yep, 2014, I think.
So he's not that far removed from the managerial ranks. I know the new commissioner in this era, but if you got the itch to go back, you got the itch to go back. So I think that the White Sox are going to be a very interesting team come next season. Of course, we'll see how the schedules go, how everything's going to go. I think it'll probably be full system go for baseball next season. But we'll see how things go, especially with these COVID cases going up and seeing how they will treat that going forward. But we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Yeah, definitely going to be a very season-long storyline, just Tony La Russa and how he's interacting with those younger players. I don't think anything will, as far as the field goes, I think he's fine there as far as, you know, day-to-day managerial stuff. My thing is just be how he's will be managing the personalities of those young players. And you know, the things that they're into off the field that he was very outspoken against a few years back. So I think that's my biggest focus, is just kind of how he's going to handle the individuals and the personalities of the players on the team in this new era of, you know, social justice and being outspoken when it comes to matters of, you know, politics and policy. So we're going to shift over to a little college football now. The biggest star in the game, Trevor Lawrence, he tested positive for the virus and he missed last week's game versus Boston College, which was a come from behind win for Clemson. And he's also going to miss this week's showdown against Notre Dame, which is going to be the national spotlight game for the country. This week, as Notre Dame, it's a big game at Notre Dame. They're breaking out the Joe Montana green jerseys, so you know it's a big deal for them. So what are your predictions, man? We saw the young freshman quarterback have to rally late with a little help from his friend Travis Etienne. They got the win over Boston College, but Notre Dame, at least defensively, is going to be a formidable test, just like Boston College was. I don't know how their passing game is, but they're really good at running the ball. So do you see Notre Dame upsetting Clemson this week at Notre Dame?
At Notre Dame, yes, I do see an upset coming, even though my good friend Sean and I, we have a saying that goes a little something like, fuck Notre Dame everything. However, I do think without sunshine on the field, Trevor Lawrence, This, you got a freshman quarterback. This is Notre Dame's ultimate opportunity, and they need to seize it. And I think they can seize it. This is this is definitely a game where I'll be watching. I mean, I really would rather this game ended a tie, but there's no ties in college football anymore, so that's not going to happen. But I do see a win for Notre Dame if they can, you know, stick to put the pressure on this young quarterback. You know, do try to limit. You're not going to contain them. Try to do as much as you can to, you know, just try to contain Etienne. But it's kind of going to be one of those things, let Etienne get his. But if you stop everybody else on the offensive side, then you have a great chance of winning. So pressure is going to be the key in this game. And if the line holds up for Clemson and the young QB has time to throw, then Clemson can pull it off. But I can see an upset happening. Do I think it will happen? I'm going to go on a limb and say yes. And I may be wrong, but we'll just have to see.
That brings us to, speaking of more virus-related issues in college football, Wisconsin has now had two games canceled. They had last week's game versus Nebraska canceled, and this upcoming week's game against Purdue has also been canceled. The Badgers have over 20 players and staff members who have tested positive for the virus. We knew that this was going to be a very difficult proposition for the Big Ten to try to get all their games in their shortened, truncated season without any mishaps or cancellations. And they only got six of them, and Wisconsin has already had to forfeit or cancel two. So I don't know. There's no way that they can make them up. They'll just have to kind of roll on with the season, I guess, as best they can. Wisconsin as a state is in a real bad situation when it comes to outbreaks of the virus. So if you were the Big Ten, do you just kind of shut them down and say, hey, we the Big Nine for the next for the next few weeks until the end of the season?
They gonna have to. I mean, right now, I mean, this at the moment, it's not even known if they're gonna be playing another game this season with this COVID outbreak. I think, like I said last week, I thought the Big Ten was right in being playing the cautious role of things and letting, you know, canceling the fall sports, things of that sort because of this. But everybody wants to play. Everybody wants to, you know, everybody's saying, let them play, let them play. And this is what's happening. And, you know, now you have Wisconsin. You know, this affects Nebraska. This affects Purdue. I mean, what if, you know, Nebraska, I'll just say Nebraska, for example, because I don't think Purdue's going to be anywhere. But what if Nebraska has, you know, a shot at a division title to play the Big Ten title game, and they can't because the game's canceled? How's that going to work out? There's so many logistics that is happening right now, and if you go with the Big Nine at this point, how are they going to determine the champion? I mean, do you go with the team that has the best record, played all their games, or what if one of these teams has no losses and the team that played their slate has won? Do you give it to the team that's got a game in hand or not? So basically right now, I guess it's a week-to-week thing at the moment, but if more people are getting infected with this virus on the program, You might just have to shut it down, go with nine at this point.
Right, right. We'll turn to some on-field Big Ten action as Ohio State defeated Penn State in what was the only top 25 matchup of the weekend. The score was 38-25. Justin Fields doing more work. Again, I noticed something about Justin Fields watching him play against Nebraska in the very first game. He does very well against cover one, cover three defenses. As long as he can pinpoint that single safety in the middle of the field, he does very well. Whenever Nebraska, and in this game, Penn State as well, whenever they had two safeties back, though, he seemed to struggle a little bit, doesn't read it out as fast, doesn't seem to want to take the check down. So that may be something that if your team is in the running for quarterback and you're thinking about Justin Fields being a option for your team, just kind of watch some Ohio State games and kind of notice the way he plays against single high safety versus two high safety, and see if you notice kind of the same struggles he has against that double safety look that I've noticed. When it was very apparent against Nebraska, they had one drive where Nebraska was in their cover two shell, and Penn State, they came out and kind of like kind of tight end heavy formation, and he had to kind of, you know, make those reads and kind of take those checkdowns, and he wasn't taking them. So they kind of struggled like two series in a row. Then they kind of came out and more of their spread offense, and then Nebraska countered with their single high look, started dropping one of their safeties down, and then Justin Fields started lighting them up. So very, very, very obvious to me that he might be one of these quarterbacks who you have to manipulate the defense with your formations and stuff for him to be successful moving forward. More Big Ten action. Michigan State, they upset Michigan 27-24. They exposed Michigan's secondary as the quarterback Lombardi for Michigan State just had a field day throwing the ball deep. Every time that Michigan State was in a little bit of trouble or backed up in their own end, they would just decide to let one rip down the field, and a lot of the times their receivers came down with it. So Jim Harbaugh is probably going to be the last hurrah for him in Michigan this year. I don't really see him surviving another subpar season, especially if they lose to Ohio State. He's already lost to Michigan State. They're probably going to lose to Notre Dame when that game comes up as well. So maybe happy trails for Jim Harbaugh, and maybe, you know, a return to the NFL is on the horizon if he decides he wants to continue coaching, because I just don't see Michigan, you know, going through another season like they've had the last few.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine. I haven't checked on him since this game, but it's just not working out. I just, much like you, I don't see Jim Harbaugh. This is his sixth year with this Michigan team. I mean, he's got people coming in, but you've had time to get your people in your system the way you wanted. You've had all these opportunities, and it's just not working, Chief. So I'm with you on this one, Don. I think that it's a wrap for Jim Harbaugh after the season. You can have all the glitz and glamour and all the flash, but if you're not getting the results, if you're not beating Ohio State, if you're not beating Michigan State, especially this Michigan State team coached by Mel Tucker, just not seeing you staying on. So, and then you got Penn State on the schedule as well. You lose that's three losses potentially right there. And And if you get, of course, we'll know. And Indiana, I mean, you got Indiana next week, and Indiana's playing well. This is not the same Indiana in the Big Ten that we're used to. So you got a game in Bloomington, you got Penn State at home, then you go to Columbus. That could be a potential four losses right there. And if you have four losses, then I would be, if I'm Jim Harbaugh, I'd be considering one of these NFL jobs real quick. Because if you want to, like you said, go back to the NFL, I mean, stay away from the Falcons. You don't have to go to the Falcons. Maybe the Chargers. I'm sure we're going to talk about the Chargers in a second, but yeah.
And then finally, Virginia Cavaliers upset North Carolina 44-41. Another disappointing, not ready for primetime performance by the Tar Heels against a team that they clearly are better than as far as the paper. But of course, they don't play games on paper. They play them inside TV sets. And North Carolina's defense is awful. They cannot stop the run, and they have difficulties with mobile quarterbacks. And Sam Howell is great, but, I mean, you can't constantly try to get your defense out of a hole each and every week. Virginia doesn't even have, you know, their best weapons, and they put up 44 against North Carolina. So still some steps to be made as far as the Matt Brown rebuild. They're not quite there yet after bounce back season last year. There's still some work to do defensively. Offensively, though, North Carolina is a beast. I mean, they have 2,000 yard receivers, 2,000 yard running backs, a quarterback who's probably going to end up being one of the top picks in the draft after next year. So, I mean, they're loaded when it comes to offense, but there's a lot to be desired when it comes to the defense. And if they can't get that fixed in these in the next year, it's going to be more disappointing results for North Carolina fans, even though they're, you know, nationally back on the map.
Yeah, the one thing, it's funny when you're talking about teams not stopping the run and things of that sort. I'm like, is he talking about the Tar Heels or the Panthers? Because, and not being ready for primetime TV again, I'm like, wait a minute, are we talking? Because it seems like it's the same thing, but yeah, I just don't. If the defense can catch up with the offense in the future, then North Carolina will be more of a threat, but it's one of those things where you can't play down the level of competition. If you're clearly the better team, you got to show that each and every time out. So when Matt Brown hits that recruiting trail, definitely focus more on the defense and see where it goes from there.
You're listening to Know the Score. I'm your host, Don DeLaRente. I'm joined by my co-host, the Libra Icon. You can find Know the Score on the web at cspn.us. You can also subscribe to the show through iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher Radio. All you have to do is look for subscribe to KTS Pod-the CSPN. So now it's time to talk a little bit of NFL to wrap up the show, Mr. Libra Icon. We have more COVID talk as Matthew Stafford and Andy Dalton have both been placed on the COVID-19 IR list. Andy Dalton coming off of a vicious hit in the Washington-Dallas game from a couple of weeks ago, where he was already in concussion protocol, but now he's dealing with concussion symptoms and COVID. And as of the recording today, Matthew Stafford this afternoon was just added to the list, so he will not be playing for the Lions this weekend. So that makes it even harder for Mr. Matt Patricia on him trying to keep his job in this season, now that he's going to have to go a game without Matthew Stafford at quarterback. NFL is getting really, really, really close to having their season thrown off the rails. You know, luckily they've kind of been able to, except for the Titans, been able to contain it to kind of ones and twos as far as the other teams go. But yeah, they're starting to get to a point where the bye weeks are getting completed, and they're not going to have too much wiggle room if they do have another team come out with an outbreak.
Yep, and so this is where, you know, they have to really kind of consider the logistics of maybe shortening the season, trying to figure out what alternative contingency plans they're going to be if these COVID cases are going to continue to rise, because not only do you have to worry about the players, you got to worry about the coaching staff, you got to worry about essential personnel. There's so many different factors here. And, you know, and especially with these winter months now, I mean, it's getting colder. You got the, especially with the flu season, there's so many different factors here. So teams are going to really have to be smart, mindful of following every single mandate to a T if they want to continue this season.
Yeah, I've heard talk that the NFL is really considering going to a 16-team playoff format if the, you know, virus does happen to play a bigger part in the season and disrupting it. They had already agreed on adding one extra playoff team to each division, so that would be 7 teams each, from up from 6 that it had been since 1986 or 1990, I think, is when the wild card came in. But definitely one of the contingency plans that they're starting to throw around is 8 teams per conference to make up a 16-team playoff for this year.
Something's gonna be done, because this is gonna get really ugly really quick.
On-field action, we turn to the Pittsburgh Steelers. They've had an interesting 2 weeks back-to-back. They took on the Titans in the Battle of the Unbeatens, jumped out to a big lead, and held on at the end when Steven Gronkowski, his nightmare season continues as he missed a short game-tying kick to send the game into overtime for Tennessee. Then the Steelers followed that up with a 28-24 comeback win over the Baltimore Ravens on the road, a game of two halves. Lamar Jackson started the game off with pick six on like the third play, but then Baltimore proceeded to bludgeon Pittsburgh for the rest of the first half, running over them, establishing a 17-7 lead. But then the second half came out. Lamar again throws another interception. Beginning of the third quarter gives the Steelers some life. And from then on, Big Ben finally got into some rhythm. The Steelers went out and scored 28 points, 28-7, second half scoring margin over Baltimore. They put the Ravens in a comeback situation to come from behind. Lamar Jackson has yet to do that in his young NFL career as a starter. And they kind of expose what the struggles are of the Baltimore Ravens once again with Lamar Jackson at quarterback. So your thoughts on first the Steelers. Are they the best team in your estimation in the NFL after the last 2 weeks?
Yes, they are. Defense is amazing. The offense has been running so smoothly. A healthy Big Ben, a great receiving core, Smith-Schuster, Deontay Johnson, and Chase Claypool, who didn't have that great of a game this week, but he's really emerged. James Conner in the backfield. You also have T.J. Watt leading that defense right now. Vince Williams, Minka Fitzpatrick, Joe Hayden,
Bud Dupree. Don't forget about my man Bud Dupree.
Absolutely. So yeah, there's a lot of great talent on that Pittsburgh defense. Well deserved 7-0. The Ravens played a good game. Lamar just made one too many mistakes, and if there's anything that's been a kryptonite for Lamar Jackson, it's been the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I think Mike Tomlin said after the game, "We respect him, but we don't fear him," which I think a lot of teams have that fear of Lamar Jackson, but Pittsburgh does not.
Well, I think Pittsburgh understands that if they basically conceded more running yards than they've given up in a long, long time in any single football game. But I think what they understood was that they wanted Lamar Jackson to throw the ball. And they figured that if they could make him have to throw the ball on, you know, third downs, critical downs, longer distances, that he would either turn it over or they would be able to hem him in and sack him. And that's kind of what happened in the second half. Lamar Jackson is still limited as far as being a passer and being able to use his receivers as main threats and main targets. They don't throw the ball. If you notice, if you watch Ravens game, everything is kind of inside the hash marks with their passing game. A lot of things are going towards middle of the field or right down the middle of the field. They rarely throw the ball to the outside of the numbers. And I think that is the biggest improvement Lamar Jackson is going to have to make personally as a quarterback, is to be able to get like the last play of the game, right? He's not going to be able to run that ball for 25 yards and score a touchdown, right? He's going to have to stand in the pocket and make a throw. And he's not at that point in his career quite yet where if teams know he's got to throw, that he can still beat them.
Yeah. I think once he can get those mechanisms down, finding a way to get the ball to the outside, yeah, he'll definitely be a more complete
quarterback. Yeah. Jimmy Garoppolo was injured once again. That bad ankle flared up. And also that Seattle defense was putting a number on the 49ers as well. The 49ers suffered a 37-27 loss to the Seahawks. Russell Wilson, after a 3-touchdown, 3-interception game and a loss to Arizona in overtime, he bounced back with 4 TD passes, no interceptions. I think 3 of those TD passes went to DK Metcalf. He caught like 12 passes for over 200 yards. The week before, Tyler Lockett caught like 15 balls for like 200 yards. So Russell Wilson spreading the love to his receivers. But I think the story is the 49ers here. Injuries and poor quarterback play have kind of led them to a very slow start this year. Do you think or do you see them now that they got 4 losses? Do you see them maybe coming to the crossroads in the year where they're like, "Hey man, Jimmy G, you're in and out of the lineup. Let's just not play you. Let's go ahead and cure these losses and see where we can get and as far as the draft goes, and maybe they're in play for one of these young quarterbacks."
I think they need to shut Jimmy G down, at least to the point where he's not playing. You're never really going to be 100% the whole season, but you got to be at least healthy to be effective. And, you know, when you're constantly changing quarterbacks, that really does affect the continuity of the team. So with that being said, I think that the 49ers should probably just shut him down, maybe probably look towards the draft, look towards the future, and get somebody who's one of these young quarterbacks that have a chance to be a next legendary 49ers quarterback. Never know, but it's just at the point where it's not worth
you know, going out there less than 100% every single week and then not finishing the game or getting hurt is just not worth that. So I think this is just one of those seasons where the Niners just may have to shut it down. And, you know, I know they had high hopes after winning the NFC Championship, losing Kansas City in the Super Bowl, trying to get back. But right now, this isn't – it's not worth it at the moment, I don't think.
George Kittle also got injured in that game. He broke a bone in his foot. So it looks like he's going to be out for about 6 to 8 weeks. So just more injury problems for the 49ers. So it looks like this season is just going to be one that's going to, you know, get swallowed up by the injury bug for them. After, like you said, coming off that Super Bowl run last year. So we'll see how they continue forward if they decide that they're going to, you know, start planning for next year. Move on to...
And they got putting three on the COVID list as well.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Brandon Ayuk, Debo Samuel, and Trent Williams are all going on the reserve COVID-19 list as well.
Oh, man. Yeah, see, it's creeping up all over the league, man. So, yeah, see, now, see, that's a problem when you start getting three and four and five people. You know, you can deal with one or two guys, but... You know, so now that means like all the offensive linemen might be in peril. That means all the receivers might be in peril because, you know, they have the meetings and they're in close contact with those guys as starters. So, going to be interesting to see how that plays out through their building leading up to Sunday's game if they get more positive tests. We'll go up to now Buffalo, where the Buffalo Bills had this game circled. And as Chris Bourbon says, no one circles the wagons like the Buffalo Bills. Thanks to a Cam Newton fumble where they were on a game-tying or game-winning drive, Buffalo Bills survive and they defeat the New England Patriots 24-21. So they have firmly established themselves as the best team in the AFC East. And now they have put themselves towards the inside track of winning that division. And finally, somebody dethroning the Patriots for the first time in 15 years. Cam Newton has not looked good since he contracted COVID and has played three games since then. And he looked a little bit better in this game. He just had a costly mistake at the end. We're starting to kind of hear some rumblings from, you know, New England about Cam and, you know, how bad that the Patriots are looking compared to how good the Bucs are starting to look. And people are starting to kind of, you know, look at Belichick kind of funny, like, the receivers are kind of iffy. Your running backs are kind of iffy. You know, this offensive line ain't really got too many players on it. So, man, how much was Tom Brady really hiding with his play? Just your thoughts on first Cam and his struggles, and then overall the Patriots in this first year without Tom Brady as a team and an organization.
Since you did mention Cam returning and not looking all that great, there's no touchdowns, five interceptions, three fumbles, one of them lost, sacked seven times, and, of course, Patriots are 0-3. Definitely something you hate to see, especially with literally a generation of Patriots fans who haven't seen a bad New England Patriots team. This is one of those situations where if the play like this continues for Cam Newton, he may not get a long-term deal with New England. He may be finding another home. After the situation and, of course, being let go for Carolina, then being out 83 nights without a team. So this is definitely something that we got to keep an eye on to see if they if his play does improve. I don't. I like you said, he did look better than he did the last couple weeks, but it still has not been pretty. I think there's still some lingering effects that are not being shown, but they are clearly there. And he may have came back too quickly. As for the Patriots as a whole, especially with the Bucs, kind of like you said, the Bucs are starting to gel, and now the Bucs are gelling. Adding Antonio Brown to the mix doesn't help the fans of New England's anguish. I think just one of those situations, yeah. A lot of conspiracy theorists and thoughts are starting to come out of New England. And I don't think it's I mean, you can put it on Belichick a little bit, but maybe, you know, with Tom Brady, he did make a lot of unknowns pretty much known. I mean, we never would have thought Deion Branch winning Super Bowl MVP and Super Bowl 39, but he did. I just think that the quarterback play has been definitely inconsistent, and you know, it's definitely hard act to follow number 12 in Foxborough. It's just one of those situations where New England's going to have to either go with Jarrett Stidham or try to find somebody in the draft to see what Belichick can do with that. So
the Kansas City Chiefs, they dominated the lowly New York Jets 35-9. We finally got to see one of those aerial displays from Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Greg Williams, always the one to take risk, did not want to die the slow death that most teams have been kind of choosing to go with when it comes to Kansas City this year. So Patrick Mahomes got to light it up, got to throw a couple of deep passes to Tyreek Hill. Everybody had been kind of asking where was the explosiveness from the Chiefs offense, and they showed that it's still there. It's just that they've been kind of taking what teams have been giving them, and the Jets gave them a chance to throw the ball, and they took advantage.
Yeah, this really was just not much else to really say about this game. I mean, the main thing with the Jets for me is why Adam Gase is still their head coach at this point. The Texans let go Bill O'Brien at 0-4. Falcons let go Dan Quinn at 0-5. Texans have been 1-2 since that firing. The Falcons have won 2 straight. I just think that this should have been done a long time ago, especially with the fact of Ryan Tannehill's success in Tennessee. A lot of people have started kind of crane their necks at Adam Gase, like, well, maybe you were the problem, because Tannehill is flourishing in Nashville while Sam Darnold is looking everything like a bust right now.
Yeah, I think statistically over the last like season worth of games that like Ryan Tannehill is like the second best quarterback in the NFL.
Right. And for years in Miami, we kind of labeled him as he's a mediocre. He has his flashes, but he's not as he wasn't up there with, you know, at the time Andrew Luck or RG3, and now he's out here. Luck's retired. RG3 is backing up Lamar in Baltimore, and Tannehill is putting up MVP-like numbers with the Titans. So it's just pretty wild how things have kind of flipped there. And I think Adam Gase is the common denominator. I think if Sam Darnold had a better head coach, a better offensive scheme, he could be doing a lot more than what he's getting right now. And the Jets, Greg Williams has the schemes, but the Jets don't have the talent on the defensive side. Of course, that's one of the reasons why Jamal Adams wanted out. It's shown every bit of why Jamal Adams wanted out, and I'm sure the Le'Veon Bell revenge game was very sweet for him as well.
Your Carolina Panthers, Mr. Libra Icon, they lost two close games in the same week to the Saints and the Falcons. Your assessment of kind of Carolina coming back to earth after they had that three-game winning streak, and what would you like to see them improve upon as Christian McCaffrey is due back either this week or next week?
One, they don't belong on national television. I want to say that right now. I was a little optimistic when I saw they had a Thursday night game. I'm like, the first thing I thought of was, oh, yay, national televised game. Carolina will shit the bed because that's what they do. Then I was like, well, it's a new regime. Let me be a little bit more optimistic here. So I decided, let me give it a chance. Julio Jones didn't play in the first Carolina-Atlanta matchup. That was one of the biggest differences in the Thursday night game last week. And then Teddy Bridgewater briefly got hurt in that game. And then he came back in the game and they were driving, but they threw a costly pick, which was also the same situation in the Saints game 3 days prior. So to answer the question of what they need to work on, they need an offensive line. Greg Little's been great on the outside. Taylor Moton's been great on the inside, but the guard play, especially a left guard, Chris Reed, allowed a lot of pressure. A lot of those dropbacks Teddy Bridgewater had in that Thursday night game was due to the fact was he's either getting hurried, sacked, or knocked down. Credit Raheem Morris, credit the Falcons defense in that game for constantly blitzing. They saw that the line could not handle that pass rush. And when they, every single time they drop back to pass, there's always somebody in Teddy's face. And because especially when you're trying to come back into a game, the line was definitely preventing the Panthers from, you know, getting down the field. I don't have a problem with the backs for the receiving corps. Mike Davis has been a great find. He's been he's no Christian McCaffrey, of course, but he's played very well. But I think teams are finally starting to figure him out a little bit. That's somewhere he would need to adjust, especially if he's going to be that change of pace of back and offsetting what CMC does. Defensive side, got to stop the run. They still can't stop the run. That's been a huge weakness there. Brian Hill, who really didn't have much of anything during the start of the season, he had a breakout game. Ito Smith ran the ball pretty well. And so the run defense, the interior on the offensive line, and they need to blitz a little bit more. And Trey Boston needs to make better reads from the safety position. And I think if they can do that, then possibly we can see the Panthers get back to maybe 500.
All right. Carson Wentz, he cemented Philly's position atop the NFC East with a win over the lowly Dallas Cowboys. They struggled a little bit, but Carson Wentz does what he does, man. It doesn't look pretty, but when it's time to make plays and get in the red zone, he usually cashes in. Dallas had to go with their seventh-round rookie quarterback, and as you could imagine, they could not muster much offense. They were even relying on the Wildcat at times in this game to try to just generate some different looks and get some things going. So I think it's safe to say at this point that the Cowboys are on their way to a top five pick in the draft next year. And do you think that, Jerry Jones is one of these guys who doesn't always exhibit patience? Do you think it might be one and done for Mike McCarthy?
I would think it wouldn't be a one and done situation given all the rash of injuries that have happened with the team, especially at the quarterback position. But I will also say at the same time, I won't be surprised if Mike McCarthy's out. I thought it was a weird hire at first anyway, given the McCarthy's history with the Packers. He was the head coach of when the whole Dez Bryant catch situation, and someone asked him about that, and I saw this look from Jerry Jones like he wanted to kill him. So I can see Jerry Jones kind of like, okay, I made a mistake. I want to pull the plug, and I want to hire somebody else. He has the money to do it anyway, so it won't hurt him too much. The Cowboys if you're having to go to the Wildcat, which hasn't really been a prevalent thing since 2008, that's just showing, it's a lost season. Ben DiNucci probably in over his head. I kind of enjoy seeing Cowboy fans suffer a little bit. So I'm not. It's just a rough thing to go with. I think they're paying for all the sins of the 90s. So that's what it is.
The Dolphins, with help behind the special teams and the defense, they dominate the Rams in a 28-17 victory. It really wasn't as close as the score would indicate. In his first career start, Tua throws his first TD pass, and he gets his first win. So a very positive day down in Miami. The passing numbers and efficiency weren't that great for Tua, but he didn't have to be that good. As like I said, the defense and special teams stepped up. They both scored touchdowns defensively and through special teams. Made the Rams look very pedestrian after they've been kind of on a roll here for a little while. So I think people are encouraged by what they saw from Tua in his first start. And now we'll just have to see if the Dolphins can maintain this momentum. They've definitely put together themselves a nice little season here after getting out of the blocks a little slow. With the help of Ryan Fitzpatrick, they've now won, I think, 3 games in a row as well. So, maybe the Dolphins are setting themselves up to be a contender in the AFC East for this year.
Yeah, I think that this was a bold move, but You spend the first round pick on a QB down days. You want to see him in right away. Not an earth shattering debut. Did enough to get the win. Dolphins, I thought this game would have been a little bit more of a blowout. I think that's what happens when you let the foot off the gas a little bit. It was a great, great weekend for the Tagovailoa household. Tua's brother at Maryland led him on a game-winning drive in overtime, and then Tua gets his first win. So, great weekend for that family. Yeah, with those two guys at quarterback, I think we'll have to see how Buffalo and Miami play it out. I know the Monday night game is going to be, since we're on the Sunday day of season, Monday night game is going to be a dread fest with the Patriots and the Jets. So we might be watching something else come Monday night.
That's going to be the elixir Cam Newton needs to get back right.
Yeah, if he can't get right against the Jets, that might fully turn the Patriots fan base on him.
One last game that we'll bring up before a couple quick hitting points that we'll bring up before we look forward to this upcoming weekend's games. First, we'll talk about Cincinnati upsetting Tennessee. Tennessee is now on the 2-game losing streak. Joe Burrow and the boys put together the plays there to build the lead, and they held on this time. They've kind of had the lead in a bunch of these games, but couldn't hold on, make enough plays on defense, but they did against the Titans. So looks like Joe Burrow, starting to get comfortable with the NFL, and he's throwing for a lot of yards. He's cutting down his turnovers, and his touchdowns are going up. So looking like things are starting to click for Joe Burrow. And the hard luck San Diego Chargers. We just used to think it was a Phillip Rivers thing, but no, it's clearly a San Diego Chargers organizational thing, as they blow a 24-point lead in the fourth quarter to the lowly Denver Broncos. Drew Lock brings them all the way back, throws a game-winning touchdown, basically as time expires, ruining a great day for Justin Herbert. Over 300 yards, 3 touchdowns, had a couple of interceptions, though. It's unfortunate that a guy like Anthony Lynn, who by all accounts is a really good coach, has had his team in positions to win a lot of games over the last 3 years that he's been a coach. He's probably going to get fired because his record in single-digit games is just awful. And like I said a couple of weeks ago, I think that the Chargers' problem is just that they don't generate enough pass rush in the fourth quarter. It's cool to sack team, get a bunch of sacks in the first half. It's cool to get a bunch of sacks in the third quarter. But if it comes to fourth quarter and you can't keep that up, then you're going to allow another team, if they have any type of good quarterbacking or explosiveness on offense, they're going to eventually come back and get you. And I think that's what's kind of been plaguing the Chargers the past couple of years, is teams who blow a lot of leads, their defense doesn't generate a lot of pass rush in the fourth quarter.
Yep. And it's funny because I made a status on Facebook after this game when I said that the Chargers are coming for the lemon booty crown of the Atlanta Falcons, because I can only imagine in a game between these two squads would be like, do you want to win the game? No. Do you want to win the game? No. Do you want to win the game? Something like that. But so, like you said, this really does suck for Anthony Lynn. This prevent, I've always said this and I stand by this, when you play prevent defense, it prevents you from winning the game.
Well, I think a lot of times too in the NFL, teams go into prevent offense where you know
they get just to one, run the clock down, and
yeah, they get to a particular point where they figure like, okay, we got 30, that's enough, and it's like, you know, what's better than 30? 33,
37, 35. Yeah, exactly. I agree. But I can kind of say this though, just because in some observations, I mean, just looking at the Falcons, those games with Dan Quinn, they were doing the same thing. I mean, you had the Todd Gurley gaffe against the Lions, aside from that, but at the same time, there's no reason why that defense should have been playing prevent that whole time. There was no kind of aggressiveness to try to stop the Lions from getting down the field and eventually winning that game. Detroit had no business winning that game. But in the Panthers' final drive, even though there was a little bit of, you know, movement from Carolina, they got halfway down the field. Actually, they got three quarters of the way down the field before the interception. But that interception, what did they do? They decided to get aggressive, put pressure on the quarterback, and ended up getting the win. And you're right, just looking at these one possession games, the Chargers are 1-5 this season.
Yeah. You can't survive if you're Anthony Lynn over the past two seasons. You can't. I think they're like 1-10 or something like that. Yeah. 2-12 or something ridiculous in one possession games. And as a first time head coach and a young head coach and a black head coach, you can't survive that, unfortunately.
Right. And guess what? The Chargers and Falcons will play December 13th in week 14. That will be an interesting matchup.
Well, we're going to look ahead to this coming week. One of the juicy matchups is going to be the Seattle Seahawks taking on the Buffalo Bills. So this will be another test for Seattle and Buffalo as well. It's kind of a measuring stick game for both teams. Interconference game, so you know, one of the best in the AFC against one of the best in the NFC, and we'll truly get a measuring stick on just how real the Buffalo Bills are after coming off of that win against the Patriots, that they leave everything on the field against the Patriots and they're not going to show up this week against Seattle, or will they be able to put a couple of good efforts back to back and you know, come out with the win over the Seahawks. So that's going to be fun to see Russell Wilson play against that defense that can really get after him with a pass rush. Pretty okay secondary as long as Josh Norman doesn't have to start. So I'm intrigued by that matchup. Other matchups of note this week, Packers versus the 49ers. Even though both teams are coming off losses, this is probably going to be like basically an elimination game for the NFC when it comes to a playoff contender. The Bears versus the Titans. Both teams coming off losses, but still pretty good records overall. Right in the middle of things in the AFC and NFC for the playoffs. The Ravens coming off that loss to the Pittsburgh Steelers, taking on the Colts, who are silently, quietly 5-2. One of the best 1-2 punches at running back. Phillip Rivers, when he keeps his turnovers down, is still effective in this league. So he's got them playing pretty well. And then the one that everybody's going to have their eyes on Sunday night, the Saints and the Bucks rematch from week one. Drastically different situations for both teams. The Saints are beat up. Their receiver situation is depleted right now. Drew Brees is looking real pedestrian because he's throwing to some no-name guys. And the Bucks have started to kind of look like round into form. Like you said, they're adding Antonio Brown this week to the mix. They've been kind of beat up at the receiver position as well, but it looks like they're going to start trying to get some of their guys back here this month. So it looks like Tom Brady is getting those boys rounded into shape in the perfect time of the season, November, heading into December, which leads you into the playoffs.
Yes. think out of all those, the one that does definitely intrigue me the most. Not even the Saints and the Bucks. I think that Seahawks-Bills matchup will be very, very intriguing. Not only going to be looking at Russell Wilson, but Josh Allen as well. And I think with the Colts and the Ravens, the Colts at 5-2, Ravens are at the same mark, I believe. So, yep, Ravens at 5-2. So, a lot of good matchups. Hopefully, the Colts don't look a little too far ahead because they got a division matchup with the Titans, which is actually going to be the Titans playing the Colts twice in 3 weeks. So, definitely a lot to watch out from there. These are two wild card teams. The Ravens are fifth right now. The Colts are sixth. And that's going to be probably the game I'll be looking out for the most as well.
All right. So at this time, Libra Icon, I'm going to turn it over to you, sir, for your final thoughts and shout-outs and thank yous.
All right. Thank you and shout-out to you, Don, for having me as always. It's always good to be on the CSPN, so shout-out to CSPN. Shout-out to all the CSPN podcasters as well. I have a final thought, and it goes to the baseball diamond. The New York Mets have a new owner. The Wilpons' reign of terror of 40 years is over. Steve Cohen is now the owner of the New York Mets. He's worth $2.4 billion. That's billion with the B. And he's already already raised the salaries of the staff to their pre-pandemic levels, which was like 5-30% already. He's a lifelong Mets fan. There was a lot of possible issues with the mayor's office, since the mayor's office is basically the landlord of the city field where the Mets play. All those hurdles were cleared, was approved, and he is basically worth more than all the other owners of New York teams combined, including the Yankees. So I'm very, very happy about that. I'm very psyched to see what plans he has for the team. If he wants to get rid of the agent turned GM, he can do that. I'm sure if we can pay to get a better improved pitching staff, because you know you got to keep DeGrom, you got to keep Syndergaard. They weren't going to pay Stroman that initial qualifying offer option, but they ended up doing it since the ownership changed. So it looks like Stroman is possibly, he could still be staying. They can get rid of Steven Matz for David Peterson. Was a great lefty this season. And if we can get one of the, if we can get another bat, then some things could be happening there. But the main thing is no more Wilpons, no more cheap maneuvers. Hey, if Steve Cohen wants to pay Bobby Bonilla off for the rest of the duration, you can go ahead. I will be all for it.
No.
No more Bobby Bonilla day.
No.
I'm gonna keep saying that.
Bobby Bonilla is not finna, no, he is not finna play that game. No, sir. You just have my 1.3 ready on July 1st for the next set. That's all. And 1.3 becomes 1.3 becomes like 1.5, becomes 1.7. So it'll end up being close to like $3 million once it's all said and done.
He can, and you know what, Steve Cohen, he can pay that all. You can pay that and more. he could probably get Bobby Bonilla set for life if he wanted to give him a little, so probably more than what he's
you know, if he wants to do that, that's perfectly fine with me.
Look here, player. I give you 7% over retail just to get this thing off my book so I can start in fresh. Will you take that? Bobby Bonilla be like, nope. Nope. Sure won't.
That's worth a shot. That's worth a shot. Man. I can
dream. Bobby Bonilla then held out this long. You think he gonna take get this close to the end and be like, yeah, I think I just take the lump sum now. Hell no.
I mean, he can. I mean, just offer him more than, yeah, he can offer him. He can do something.
My final thought is just going to be about the NASCAR playoffs. Give a big shout out to Chase Elliott. He was in a position where he had to go out and win the last race before the championship race at Martinsville to qualify for the championship four. And that's exactly what he did. He dominated the second half of the race. He led about 238 of the 500 laps at NASCAR's oldest track. It's one of the first situations in his young career where he, you know, was had a must-win situation and he delivered. He is the face of NASCAR, the new young face of NASCAR, so it would mean a lot for them marketing-wise heading into next year if he was able to somehow win the championship this Sunday in Phoenix. It's going to be Chase Elliott, Brad Keselowski, Denny Hamlin, and Joey Logano, your final four contestants for this year's NASCAR championship. Basically, they'll be racing against each other inside of this race, so whoever finishes in the better position among those four will be the champion for this season. So the best way to do that is just go out there, dominate, and win the race. Chase Elliott historically has not really done that well at Phoenix. It's kind of one of his, you know, mediocre tracks. Denny Hamlin has done really well at Phoenix. Brad Keselowski has done really well at Phoenix as well. So I would look for those two guys to kind of be your favorites going into it. And then Logano maybe third and Chase fourth just based on the track. But it's going to be very interesting to see how it all shakes out. For the last race of Jimmy Johnson's career, he's going to hang up the fire suit in NASCAR after this year. Seven-time champion, one of the all-time greats to ever do it. His career is going to come to a close for NASCAR, but don't be surprised if you see him in an IndyCar, some road courses, and maybe the Indianapolis 500 in a couple of years. He's been kind of flirting around with some IndyCar stuff, so he looks like he's going to trade one career for another one, at least part-time. So, you know, tip of the cap to Jimmy Johnson for such a great career. And I'm looking forward to the championship race on Sunday. Give a big shout out and thank you to the Libra icon for joining me here on Know the Score. Thank you to everybody who listens to the show, everybody who subscribes through CSPN.us. We greatly appreciate it. Support the podcast over on CSPN.us by going to the tab that says Keep Our Podcast Free. Do some shopping with Amazon. Some of your purchase comes back to the CSPN to keep Know the Score free each and every week. Also, check out the Patreon page, patreon.com/CSPN Media. There you can check out Know the Score OT, where we have pre and post show conversations, where we talk sports with some of the various other hosts of the shows here on the CSPN, as well as the Libra icon, Dwayne. Some things that we don't talk about on the regular show, you can catch over there. Again, that's patreon.com/CSPN Media. So for my co-host, the Libra icon, Dwayne, I'm your host, Don DeLaRente, and now you know the score.